Welcome to a special gala off-year election edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, I have some sports scores to tell
you. Yeah, let's start with the sports.
New York 23, California 10.
And so New York won all the attention.
But before we go to the special congressional elections, I think we should talk about yesterday's gubernatorial elections, where Virginia and New Jersey elected two new governors.
Both Republicans. And that seems to have gotten a great deal of attention.
Well, it should if the only gubernatorial game in town is Virginia and New Jersey, and Republicans replace Democrats in both. I think it's obviously a clear repudiation of Barack Obama's leadership and that health care is dead.
You know, you actually don't think either of those two things. And one of the reasons that you don't think either of those two things is because the voters were asked quite explicitly in both states, are you voting to express your opinion about Barack Obama or his program? And clear majorities in both states said no. And among those who said they were voting about Obama, the pro-con split was more people voting against Obama's program than for it. But it was a split vote, and most people said it wasn't a part of their decision.
That's true. I mean, we've seen over and over again that these are the kind of elections that are determined on local issues, and the taxes and the economy were clearly the issues in New Jersey and Virginia. But I still think it sent a bad message to Democrats, or maybe just sent a bad message to incumbents, because the incumbents in the two states were Democrats, although they were not running for re-election in Virginia, and voters seemed to be unhappy with the way both states were being run.
I think that voters were sending a positive message to Republican candidates as much as they were sending a negative message specifically to Democrats, because Republicans' overall image has fallen very low. And in a couple of instances here, we've seen where they can really change their luck if they've got a better candidate mix. In Virginia, they had a stronger candidate in Bob McDonnell, who showed a lot more appeal, ran a much more disciplined and focused campaign. And the Democratic candidate, Cree Deeds, never really made a rationale for his candidacy at all, except that in the primary, he wasn't Terry McAuliffe, who turned out to be unpopular with Virginia Democrats.
Wasn't Brian Moran, the liberal from Northern Virginia, right?
And so he kind of survived in that primary. And then the rest of his campaign largely consisted of trying to make out Bob McDonnell as who he was 20-some years ago when he wrote a thesis in his Regent University days. And that, when that episode was over, seemed to be the end of the Deeds campaign. He didn't really ever decide whether he wanted to run with Obama or arm's length from Obama. And clearly, the Democratic streak in Virginia was not just about being a Democratic streak. It was about having better candidates.
Democrats were also complaining that Bob McDonnell is really a right-wing zealot ideologue who was disguised as a moderate. But I think that they missed the point completely. The point is, he ran a very disciplined campaign. Conservatives knew that he comes from the conservative wing of the Republican Party, social conservative positions, the Pat Robertson stuff back in the 1980s. But he also ran a very positive, smiling kind of campaign, talking about infrastructure and transportation. Transportation is a big issue, especially in Northern Virginia, which has been a Democratic bastion for many years. And Cree Deeds, as you said, spent most of the time running a negative campaign. Once upon a time in the June primary, many Democrats thought Deeds was the perfect Democrat because he wasn't
moderate.
He wasn't a liberal. He wasn't
south part of the state.
Right. And he spoke the language of many rural Virginians who had been voting Republican in the past. But what I thought was most striking about Virginia, and to a similar extent in New Jersey, that independents went for the Republican candidates.
Yeah, I think they broke 2-1 in New Jersey. And there is another bridge between the two in terms of their significance. And maybe this is belaboring a point, but I think it is an important justification for a lot of the coverage. And that is that Virginia had been on a bit of a roll for the Democrats. Not only did Obama carry it, first Democrat since 1964 in a presidential election, but also they had won the last two governor's races, and they had won the last two Senate races. That's quite a run in Virginia, given the recent history of the Democratic Party in the state. And in New Jersey, I believe Chris Christie is the first Republican elected statewide in that state in a dozen years.
Right, since 1997, when another Christie, Christine Todd Whitman, was reelected.
No relation.
But I think if you ask voters in New Jersey, are they better off now than they were 4 years ago, I think an overwhelming majority, including Democrats, would say they were not. The economy has tanked. Corzine ran for governor 4 years ago, leaving the Senate early because of his experience as a Goldman Sachs executive. He knew the business.
Can-do executive.
And yet he couldn't do because the economy did worse. Property taxes did not go down.
Highest property taxes in the country.
That's been a perennial issue in New Jersey for decades. But Corzine said he would change the plight of most of these people in New Jersey, and he did not.
Unemployment is 10%.
Yeah.
And we might add, corruption, which has been an endemic problem in New Jersey, has continued apparently unabated.
Right. And of course, exit polls say that voters were mostly not concerned about the corruption. But the fact is that there was a major corruption arrest this summer in New Jersey when many Democratic assemblymen and mayors, people close to Corzine, were arrested. And that fit in perfectly with Chris Christie, who, as a former U.S. attorney, ran on the issue of corruption.
Now, given this entire catalog of horrors, I think the big question for a lot of people in the New Jersey race all fall has been, why is John Corzine even a factor in this race, given that it should be a 60-40 blowout loss for whoever's the governor, regardless of party?
Well, part of it is money. Chris Christie took public financing, and John Corzine spent out of his own pocket, his very deep pockets. He spent $26 million of his own money. And two, I think Corzine decided from the beginning that I'm not going to turn voters around about my record. What I will do is focus on Chris Christie.
And hammered him.
Relentlessly, and I think effectively as well, because there are a lot of questions about Chris Christie, his relationship with Karl Rove, whether he may have politicized his job when he was a federal prosecutor. So for many New Jersey voters, there were as many questions about Chris Christie as there were about John Corzine.
And for a time, it looked as though there might be a third option. Remember, on our last podcast, we had some fun with a rather cheesy commercial that had been made by Chris Daggett, the third-party candidate, who in the end disappeared.
Perhaps because of the podcast, maybe.
I think the podcast killed him.
But actually, when voters were clearly not happy with Corzine, they had questions about Christie, there was a third-party alternative in Chris Daggett. But as we've seen in almost every state, maybe Jesse Ventura is one of the few exceptions, as we get closer to November, voters decide that they don't want to waste a vote. And they felt that perhaps maybe there was some attraction to Daggett, but if it's going to help reelect John Corzine, I'm going to come back to my original choice, which was Chris Christie.
And that apparently is pretty much what happened, because the eventual numbers suggest that Corzine stuck pretty well at what appeared to be what he would get in a natural election without a third-party candidate.
And what it also means, and you know, we talk about what it means down the road, go back to 2001, less than 2 months after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, when Democrats took both the Virginia and the New Jersey gubernatorial race, and yet 2002, the following year, Republicans made historic gains because they were the in-party of the White House in Congress in both the House and Senate. So we can talk about what this means. I think it means a lot for 2009. I'm not sure if it means anything else for 2010 or beyond.
I do think that we saw some trends, though, this fall. And again, this goes back to the Republicans kind of getting their act together, feeling better about being Republicans, getting over the shock of the entire Obama phenomenon, and realizing that they can turn some of the issues that Obama used against George W. Bush a year ago against Obama, the recession primarily. This will last well into 2010, and if it gets anywhere close to the November voting in 2010, that recession is going to be a killer for a lot of marginal Democratic candidates for the Senate and the House.
But if the Republicans learned a lesson in Virginia by running a conservative, running as a moderate, and if they learned a lesson in New Jersey, I'm not sure they learned any lesson in New York 23.
Here's what happens in New York 23. You get a lot of people from outside of the state of New York. Not only were they outside of the Adirondack Mountains, they were not part of this enormous geographic district that goes all the way from Lake Champlain west to Lake Ontario. They came in from around the country. Sarah Palin from Alaska, Dick Armey from Texas, Tim Pawlenty from Minnesota.
Fred Thompson, right.
And I was just going to say, if you want a one-liner for what went wrong for the Republicans in the Adirondack Mountains, it would have to be the Fred Thompson curse. So we had all these people from outside the district voicing their opinion, saying that the Republican nominee, Dede Scozzafaba, was inadequately conservative.
Well, that's fair to say.
And my gosh, she's not any kind of conservative, right, as far as most people would say. Right. She was a relative moderate on fiscal issues, but she was a liberal on the social issues.
Pro-gay marriage, pro-abortion rights, things
that's
like
right.
that.
That's right, pro-pasta.
Anti-M.
So all these people weigh in, whether they physically came to the district or just made a big splash in the national media about it. And the people in the district were resentful of this, and Dede Scozzafaba felt utterly undercut, even though she still had the official support of the National Republican Party. And 3 days before the election, she just literally said, I'm not running for this office anymore. If I don't have this kind of support from the Republican Party, if I'm seen as somehow the bad person here, I'm just out of it. And the next day, she actually went so far as to endorse the Democrat, confusing the situation further.
Well, it did buttress the argument from conservatives that she was hardly a conservative at all.
A true Republican, national Republican.
Apparently, she met with people in the White House that led to her endorsing Bill Owens.
They certainly tried to push her in that direction after she had dropped out.
And there are two ways of looking at this. I mean, the moderates or the big tent, the Newt Gingriches of the world could say that we can't win if we only are a conservative / right-wing party.
It's a funny thing coming from Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, well,
where a lot of people are going to find it a little hard to believe that Newt Gingrich was the guy saying we should have a big tent that includes people like Dede Scozzafaba.
Although people forget that in 1964, Newt Gingrich supported Nelson Rockefeller for president. Did you know that?
Yes, but at that time.
Yes, I know. No, Newt Gingrich is Newt Gingrich. And I never thought he was a true ideologue like a Dick Armey or something like that who was, you know, in power.
I think that's what Dick Armey thought.
So anyway, if the argument is that we're going to push out the Arlen Specters, the Didi Skozavavas, we remain a very conservative party that is strong in the South, strong in some Rocky Mountain states, and nowhere else. But others will make the argument that if we're a party that stands for anything, smaller government, low taxes, life, which is, you know, in their words, then you can have a candidate like Didi Skozavava, who is the antithesis of everything the party supposedly stands for.
The real division here is between people who think that elections are determined by ideology and positions on issues and stands that are taken on questions of public policy on the one hand, and people who feel you have to put an overlay of candidacy on top of that, that the person, the individual, is critically important so that you can have one set of ideas presented by, say, Barry Goldwater, and then have the exact same set of ideas presented by Ronald Reagan, and it sells vastly differently depending on which of those two people is the standard bearer.
And the times changed too. I mean, 1964 was not a time to elect a Republican. 1980 was not a time to re-elect Jimmy Carter, but you're right.
So candidacy and the candidacy matchup can really be crucial. Now, you see this in Virginia with Deeds and McDonnell. In New Jersey, you see the overwhelming rejection of Corzine. And in upstate New York, what you see is Doug Hoffman coming from nowhere, a Republican on the conservative party line, adopted at the last moment by the rest of the Republican Party that thought it was endorsing somebody else, and supposedly, according to the polls, sweeping to victory on Election Day. But full props to you, Ken. You said over the weekend, no, I think in the end, even though the Republicans now look united, I think this dropout by Skozavava will help Owens.
I did think Owens was going to win. But another question is, what lesson do Republicans learn, if any? Does this transfer, even though Doug Hoffman lost in this historically Republican district?
Back to the 1800s.
1800s.
The last non-Republican was a Whig. Is this true?
It was a toupee. But even though Hoffman did not win, did the conservatives take the message out that this is a pure party and we repeat these tactics in, for example, the Florida 2010 Senate race with so-called Rhino Governor Charlie Crist running against Marco Rubio, who was a true blue conservative? Or do they look for somebody who can win in November? And that's the question they're going to have to deal
with.
And
I don't think that question can be resolved at this point. I think a lot of Republicans thought that a Doug Hoffman win as the conservative party candidate was going to settle that argument. It was going to say, all right, from now on, we have got to go straight at these moderates, these Republicans in name only. There's something like a dozen races where they've already targeted people. This includes Rob Simmons in Connecticut, who looked like a very strong Republican candidate for the Senate. And you mentioned Charlie Crist.
Bob Bennett in Utah?
Bob Bennett, who was thought to be practically
very conservative.
Well, not only a conservative figure, but also a revered figure in Utah, someone whose father was the senator and so on. He's not seen as a centrist or a moderate in Washington. He's seen as a conservative. So if even people such as these are going to be targeted and possibly truly stressed for their nominations in 2010, then I think this kind of Hoffman-style politics, driven by guys like Dick Armey and the Tea Party, is a problem for the Republican Party.
Before we leave congressional races altogether, one thing to mention: in California 10 yesterday, wasn't a big cliffhanger, a solidly Democratic district that Ellen Tauscher gave up to join the State Department. John Garamendi, the state's lieutenant governor, comfortably defeated David Harmer, the Republican candidate, to hold that seat for the Democrats.
And that got absolutely no attention whatsoever, even though that district could arguably be called more of a historically swing district than the one up in New York. Now, redistricting changed it. When Ellen Tauscher won it, it was still kind of a Republican district.
Correct, in 96.
But they changed it to make it safer for her in 2000, and the Bay Area has trended very much toward the left over that last two decades.
Big city mayors, I think you start with New York, not because it was a surprise.
No, because it was close.
But that was a shocker. Michael Bloomberg, who rammed through overturning term limits, I think by most accounts, Michael Bloomberg was a popular mayor, but the fact how he got to be able to run for a third term with a compliant city council to spend $100 million.
$100 million. Yeah. This is not a notional figure. This is what he spent.
His money.
And it's the biggest self-financed candidacy in American political history.
Absolutely.
And it was for a mayor's office.
And he got 51% of the vote. He attacked William Thompson, the city controller.
Who nobody had ever really thought about.
Who had no money, who had no chance of winning. And yet there was an uprising, apparently, as with Corzine, who had tons of money. But Bloomberg had so much more. 51% of the vote.
At what point do you think that $100 million started working against him? Maybe the first 50 million was okay, but the second 50 million started to kind of turn people against him?
You know something? There was a conflict between the accomplishments that Michael Bloomberg did in his two terms and the arrogance that a lot of people saw in somebody who was basically buying a third term and running roughshod over anybody who stood in his way.
A few other interesting races around the country. Let's talk about Atlanta and Mary Norwood, who would be the first white mayor of Atlanta since, I believe, the last one was elected in 1972 or thereabouts.
The last white mayor was elected in 1969. Maynard Jackson was elected in 73. There's been African-American mayors of Atlanta ever since, but because Mary Norwood did not get a majority of the vote, goes to a December runoff.
And her opponent will be an African-American.
It's going to be very interesting to see how race plays in that race. Also, in Houston mayor, sexual orientation did not play a role.
Interesting that it was not an issue.
Never was, right. Anise Parker, who was a city controller, been on the city council for years, she goes into a runoff, also a December runoff. If elected, she would be the first gay female to be elected mayor in any large American city.
Now, the turnout there was absolutely abysmal. It was something like 12-13%, I saw one estimate. Why so little interest in this race? It was a large field of candidates, a lot of people who were city council members, people with a lot of backing, people who spent a lot of their own money. Why so few people coming out to vote?
Well, I don't know the honest answer, but I suspect there was not many differences on the issues. I mean, they all felt the same thing about transportation and zoning problems and whatever any big mayor has. But the fact is that it could be the first gay female mayor, the second African-American mayor, which in the runoff, and yet race and sexual orientation had nothing to do with it. It was practical politics, not ideology, and it didn't bring out a big turnout.
And the candidate who was the big self-financing candidate there did not make the runoff.
Right, finished third.
In Detroit, Dave Bing, NBA Hall of Famer.
A lot of hoopla.
And he was reelected.
He was. And Thomas Menino in Boston, the longest-serving mayor in Boston history, won an unprecedented fifth term.
While we're in New England, let's go up a little bit further north to Maine, where a closely watched referendum on gay marriage, which had actually already been passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, that measure takes that back off the books.
Right. Actually, it never went into effect because the referendum was, it would be conditional on the voters passing it.
That's correct.
And what happened in Maine on Tuesday is what has happened in every instance in the country's history. Voters have never approved a gay marriage referendum in any ballot proposal. So once again, it was not a good result for proponents of same-sex marriage. And, you know, a gay marriage will be an issue. I think it's just not going to go away. Every time it appears on the ballot, the voters vote it down. And it's going to be an issue in 2010 in battles for state legislature. In Iowa already, Republicans are running against gay marriage. That is the law of the land in Iowa, one of the five states to have that.
And the presidential candidates coming in there in 2011 are certainly going to make an issue of that.
And those candidates will be Republican candidates. And, we saw it interesting that once upon a time we thought that Tim Pawlenty was the moderate in the Republican field.
But, and he may be, relatively
And he
speaking.
May be, but you saw with his early endorsement of Doug Hoffman, he realized that the conservative train is about to leave the station, and if you want to be president, or at least the Republican presidential nominee in 2012, you better get on it.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.